Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to All Exits Closed. My guest today is my friend Steve Greenfield, and Steve is going to talk about Super Tuesday and what it means, particularly with the student loan debt. Steve, how are you doing?
I'm, doing okay in my personal life. Obviously, we have these conversations to talk about public affairs life, and in that realm, I'd have to say that things are looking as dark and dismal right now as anyone could have imagined.
Right. So, I believe it was South Carolina, Biden pulled through, and then all of a sudden Super Tuesday happened, and Klobuchar jumped off the wagon, and Mayor Pete jumped off the wagon, and Bloomberg jumped off the wagon. So what do you see in store?
What I see in store, actually, maybe you can hear this. I have to listen to a page for a second. The fire page just came in. It's a car accident. Let me just listen if it's serious. Okay, no. This is a rescue squad call. It doesn't require my attention. Sorry, we talked about this. We were going to do this yesterday, and we had a brush fire. As fate would have it, that was a page right there. But it's for the rescue squad, not for the fire department. So we can continue. What happened is pretty much what everybody was expecting to happen from the beginning. There was no question that the Democratic National Committee had done a lot of prep work before Biden entered the race, because that he was going to be a candidate was hardly treated as a secret. He was making appearances and talking about his future candidacy prior to his announcement. And, there was no clamor among the public. There was no, we must have Joe Biden run for president to save us from Trump happening at that time. That was clearly all being engineered by critical power structures, in the private and public political world at that time. And there was no reason to bring Joe Biden into the race with so many other capable people across the entire spectrum from left to center to right of the Democratic Party with significant public service resumes already announced for the race. There was no public clamor for Joe to enter. There was certainly no electoral history in his history to indicate that he would be a powerhouse candidate, because he's from Delaware, one of the tiniest states in the country. And in his two previous attempts to run for president, he lasted only for a few weeks and hardly got any votes. So there was no logic or sense that there was either a mathematical or popular demand that Biden come in and somehow be the force by which we'll be saved from Donald Trump, as if there was nobody else that could stand in for that role that had public profiles and were already present in the race. And, distinct among everybody who was entering the race, what Joe Biden did represent was something that we've been told year after year after year is not the ethos of American liberalism or the the Democratic Party anymore. We keep being told, vote for the Democrats because they look like America. They keep showing us they look like America. And when the race was starting to form, they were showing us Kamala Harris. They were showing us Bernie Sanders. They were showing us Liz Warren. They were showing us Cory Booker. They were showing us, everybody keeps us like, look at this field. This is a great field. This is the party that looks like America. And all of them, as I said, no matter whether I agree with them or disagree with where they stand along the ideological spectrum, they all had significant public service and electoral victory resumes to point to as the background they were bringing into the race. And then along comes Joe Biden, the old WASPy guy, who's been a senator from America's state that's only distinction is that it's the one with the least corporate regulations, and he's been in the Senate since the 1970s, you know, that's what they bring forward to be the thing that's going to save us from Donald Trump. The one option they have that does not look like America, that does not look like the meme they've been beating into us about, you know, what the Democratic Party represents versus what the conservatives and the Republican Party represent. They are taking a WASPy guy, a WASPy establishment guy in his 70s, and they're running him against a WASPy guy in his 70s. So let's just dismiss what that's about and how we get to see what the Democratic Party is really about, because this did not happen by accident just the other day, you know, on Super Tuesday or starting in South Carolina. This happened from the months leading up to the Joe Biden announcement when, you know, all the backroom conversations were being held about bringing him forth as the central candidate, as the candidate that it would be expected that the primary process would gradually lead to prove that there was a healthy process around which everyone could ultimately unify, right? This was engineered from day one to lead to this outcome. And all that's really happened this week is that they sped up the outcome because certain things hadn't gone the way they expected. Let's look back a little bit and remember that the impeachment investigation was opened literally within 2 or 3 days of when the first national polls were showing Elizabeth Warren had inched ahead of Joe Biden for the front runner status, you know, ahead of the onset of the primary season. And that the central theme of the impeachment was Joe Biden is the candidate Trump fears the most. We needed
right.
to be reminded of that. We needed to be reminded that we need to nominate the candidate that Trump fears the most, and that that phone call proved that Joe Biden is the candidate that Trump fears the most, even though there are recorded statements that, you know, that in 2016 that Bernie Sanders was the candidate that Trump feared the most. But that's how they engineered the impeachment. And sure enough, by, you know, halfway through the impeachment, Warren was no longer at the top of the polls. And now you can see, you know, she's pretty much disappeared entirely. And that was all Nancy Pelosi's doing. That was not the doing of a sexist, male-oriented voting public. That was a deliberate choice on Nancy Pelosi's part to restore Joe Biden, to restore the WASP, the elderly establishment WASP male, to dominance in the polls over the rising, more progressive woman. You know, that's what we saw. That's what brought us to where we are. And as Joe Biden was not regaining any of his lost traction, conversations were held in, you know, among party insiders to say, well, we need to accelerate the process. Bernie, momentum is a big deal in the media. People talk about momentum, and Bernie has the momentum, and we need to shut it down right now. It can't go any further. Super Tuesday is the media depiction of momentum will disappear immediately if we can contain Super Tuesday. And so that's why everyone dropped out 2 days before Super Tuesday and suddenly found themselves on podiums in giant rallies endorsing Joe Biden. Right? And it had it did what it did. And what it's what it did because of the topic of yeah.
Let me ask you this question, and I think it's really important. You and I have had many conversations. We've done many podcasts on the student loan debt crisis. But if Nancy Pelosi orchestrated all this stuff and if Trump is reelected, he might have the ability to elect a couple more Supreme Court justices. And if that happens, Roe v. Wade might be overturned. And, you know, Nancy Pelosi, who's supposed to be this feminist, is putting women who support Roe v. Wade, she's kicking the hell out of them.
Well, here's the thing. I was about to get to the student debt component of it because obviously the two candidates who collapsed on Super Tuesday just happened to be the two candidates who support alleviating student debt, right? That's who collapsed. Sanders and Warren collapsed. And they are under attack specifically because of that element of their platforms, as well as a little bit more beyond that in terms of overall banking system regulation, which, by the way, is not anti-banking, but as we found out in 2008 and prior to that in 1929, those regulations are designed to actually keep the private banking system healthy and not collapsing, right? These are not anti-banking, these are pro-banking regulations that they're proposing. Neither were proposing that we have a national bank and eliminate private banks, you know, like they proposed for health insurance. They were only proposing regulations that would keep the private banking industry healthy and safe from collapse and the need for bailouts. But they are the two candidates that were promoting student debt relief. And the thing that you want to see about that, about why that happens and why something like Roe and protecting reproductive rights is a secondary issue, is because the head of the Democrats in the House, which is Nancy Pelosi, is from San Francisco. And the head of the Democrats in the Senate, which is Chuck Schumer, is from New York, New York City specifically. And the thing that's distinctive about those two cities is that they are the East Coast and West Coast banking industry centers. Okay, we obviously, Wall Street is in New York City, Wall Street itself. And San Francisco is where the West Coast stock market is, right? We don't have just one stock market in this country. We have two, just like the London market and the Hong Kong market, and right? In America, we have the East, you know, our East Coast market city, which is New York. And on the West Coast, we have the West Coast market city, which is San Francisco, you know, where Bank of America is located and the West Coast Stock Exchange is located. And those are the electoral bases of the respective leaders of the Democratic Party in the two houses. And where is Joe Biden from, their preferred candidate, is from Delaware, which is distinct amongst all 50 states as being the one place that has no corporate taxes and no banking regulations whatsoever, which is why so many banks are registered in Delaware, registered as corporations in Delaware, even though their operations are primarily elsewhere in the United States. They have their corporate licenses in Delaware. And so this is exactly what it looks like. This is the power you're seeing, once again, as we've seen throughout our history, the overwhelming power of the private financial sector over every element of our lives, over democracy itself, right? Being able to manipulate and shut down democracy by the sheer power of its money, its media, its embedded politicians at the pinnacles of power within both parties. Look, the Democratic Party does not look like America, because America doesn't just look like its genders and skin colors. Okay, the Democratic Party does not look like America because the Speaker of the House is from the banking establishment, and because the minority leader of the Senate, who's hoping to become the majority leader of the Senate and has been the majority leader of the Senate, is from the banking establishment, and the candidate that they're promoting to be the next president of the United States is from the banking establishment. And also, interestingly enough, is an elderly, waspy guy, not someone who even biologically looks like America. And so, you know, this really pulls the veil back and shows you the kind of thing that I've been talking to you about pretty much every time we speak, which is that we do not have the option of voting for somebody who is not a directly embedded representative of the finance community, of the financial power underpinning all of global capitalism, because that's what Wall Street is. These companies aren't just American companies that are traded on the New York and San Francisco exchanges. They're companies from anywhere in the world. You can buy stock in a Russian oil company if you want to on these exchanges. There's no borders. The banking community has no borders. You know, so this is what we're facing right now. We're facing, once again, looking at the triumph of the power of the private financial sector, not just in the United States, but worldwide, right? Because if you look throughout the world, we only have two kinds of elected leaders in the world right now, right? We have your Joe Biden types like Macron in France, you know, your sort of socially liberal, banking-centric, you know, people that, and beyond that, we have Boris Johnson, we have Donald Trump, you know, we have Duda, we have Bolsonaro in Brazil, we have like the extreme right-wing authoritarians, and so either way, the private for-profit financial community and industry maintains its total dominance over all global politics, whether it's democratically, quote-unquote, democratically elected politics, or whether it's military dictators, or whether it's right-wing authoritarians. It all comes back to the same thing, which is that the aristocracy of the banking community, of the finance community, of the fossil fuel community, of the military industrial complex community that manufactures the enforcement tools of these communities, they tend to get what they want, you know, and so okay, they're getting it again. And so, yeah, your student debt alleviation goal is for the time being dead unless more progressive Democrats over the next couple of months, because remember, Super Tuesday did not provide a majority. Super Tuesday only accounts for one third of available delegates. There's a lot more still ahead of us primary-wise, but clearly the momentum has now shifted. There's been a sea change. There's been a complete reversal of momentum and media messaging about momentum, and since Democratic primary voters definitely care only about beating Trump more than anything else that they might seek government to do once Trump is beaten, you know, the odds that the social benefit, you know, that is being suggested by the candidates that have lost momentum is probably not going to return to any traction to the majority. There has to be a real effort to remind people that it was the you know, Obama and the Clinton administrations beforehand that led to the unbelievable outcome of people feeling badly enough about their circumstances and their futures to elect Donald Trump, and that, you know, the Democrats are now doubling down and doing it again because they would rather have Trump win than have people relieved of their student debt. That's the bottom line, literally.
Okay, there's 46 million Americans with student debt. 46 million. That's a number that I can't hardly comprehend. If all of them would wake up tomorrow and realize, hey, Biden's not going to help us, why isn't that concept sinking into them that Biden is the one that created this mess in the first place?
Because there just really hasn't been enough mention in the media about Biden holding that specific title. I mean, right, you and I talk about it all the time because it's just factually true that he was the person who submitted the amendment that's, you know, to the bankruptcy bill that would exclude student loans from being dischargeable with bankruptcy. So it's just objectively and factually true that Biden is that person. But how much have you heard that spoken about in the debates, in the media, when they have pundits talking about critical issues about the election? Have you ever seen a single one of them bring up Joe Biden as the specific origin of this problem and the person who wrote law to ensure that government would not be able to provide relief for it? You know, there's been no talk about it. So nobody's really thinking about that. All the talk is about electability, electability, electability. And that message is so pervasive that everyone's already forgotten that it's only 3 years since we were being told electability, 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 and then the election
right.
was lost, and the election was lost. This is not an electability matter. We were told that last time, and that election was lost to what was on paper the most unelectable major party candidate in the history of the United States. Like an absolute buffoon who had no government background, never had gotten a vote. He was an internet troll, a Twitter troll. and a racist and a reality show host, and he beat what the Democrats told us was the most qualified candidate in the history of America, who, by the way, and I will agree with this, was bringing to her campaign the prospect for ending a terrible oversight of the United States, in which we are unique in the industrialized world, in that we've never had, we've never elected a woman to be our head of state. And, you know, even the idea that women would rally behind that, the way black people rallied behind Obama to end that, you know, historic problem. It turns out that Hillary attracted a lower percentage of the female vote than all the male Democrats that ran, you know, that ran before her. And so here we are being reminded every day that the only thing we're supposed to care about this year, like screw policy, we can get back to that several years from now. For now, electability is the only thing that matters. And we were just told that. It wasn't something that failed back in, you know, 1988. This just happened. This just happened. This is the most fresh election cycle in our minds. It just happened. We were told to drop all concerns except electability, and we did that, and the election was lost. And so here we are again being – nobody's talking about 46 million people struggling under student debt, and who's the one candidate of the entire field that's directly responsible for that. They're all talking about electability, and they're talking about it on the exact same terms that they talked about it 3 years ago without even – the woman element being part of it, because we're back to a crusty old white guy again, you know, is not going to attract the female vote, just as the, you know, couple of million of the so-called Pumas, the women in 2008 who stayed home and didn't vote for Obama because they had been hoping to vote for their first chance at a woman president. So that's now brought back into the picture. No one's talking about what that represents to the electability question. Nobody's talking about how, you know, we focus on banking on this particular program, but Biden is not only also responsible for the mass incarceration crisis in the African-American community, and the mass incarceration crisis has much more layers than most people even talk about, because as you know, in most states, once you have a felony conviction, you're never going to vote again. So you've lost your right to vote. Black people had their right to vote taken away by Joe Biden. Yeah. They had their right to employment taken away by Joe Biden. They're never going to work anywhere but a car wash or a McDonald's, because they have to check the box on an application that says, have you ever been convicted of a felony? They have to check yes. So millions of black people have lost their right to work and their right to vote because of Joe Biden. You know, there was a substantial collapse of the black vote in 2016 that also contributed heavily to why Hillary Clinton lost. And nobody's going to pretend that Joe Biden is the antidote to that. He's still running, making sure that we call that crime bill the Biden crime bill. He wants everyone to know, unlike student debt, Biden actually wants everyone to associate him directly with this law that caused the mass incarceration crisis, the permanent loss of employability, the permanent loss of voting rights, you know, overwhelmingly targeting African Americans. And, you know, where's that in the discussion about electability? You know, where's it, you know, so this goes beyond just the, you know, the student loan focus of this conversation we're having. This exposes, going back to where we started, exactly what the Democratic Party is all about, which is not being a party that looks like America, but only looks like America insofar as that conforms with the demands of the banking industry and the military-industrial complex and the fossil fuel industry. And whenever you know, diversity ends up running up against those core principles, that's the end of diversity. We go straight to the white Christian guy, you know. So the whole diversity thing—it's a scam. It's a veneer. It's a curtain that they hold across the East Coast and West Coast banking communities that Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. Again, I'm gonna say this one more time. I know I start to sound like a broken record, but if anybody thinks that it's an accident that both the leader of the Senate caucus and the leader of the House caucus are on the payrolls of the banking community, are from the stock market trading capitals of this country, that goes beyond naivete, right? You have to cut mm-hmm. right through that and recognize mm-hmm. that you've got a an embedded Wall Street. While all her money, you know, her biggest donation money comes from the bankers because she's from San Francisco, and that's where money comes from in San Francisco. And Chuck Schumer is from New York. He's long been called, you know, Senator Wall Street. He's the one that's promised that there will never be a federal transaction tax on stock and bond transfers, right? Because that's mm-hmm. the industry he represents, the same way that representatives from Michigan tend to represent the automobile industry, right? We understand the mechanics of how this happens. But both caucuses of the United States legislature, in both the House and the Senate, are under the direct control. And control is really the key word here, right? Because the House and Senate leaders of each party, they're the people that appoint members to committees that they're going to sit on. They're the ones that determine how long you're going to keep your seniority on any committee. If you're not playing ball, they'll transfer you from a committee where you already have 18 years of seniority and put you on a new one where your seniority level is zero. They have these powers, right? It's not just like they elect a leader and then that person is kind of a spokesperson for the caucus. The leaders mm-hmm. in the two houses have genuine power to exercise over their own members, and they do it, you know. And, mm-hmm. and so you've got New York and San Francisco running the Senate and the House. You've got the principal donation pools from New York and San Francisco running the Democrats in both the Senate and the House. And then, of course, yeah, Delaware, Joe Biden of Delaware. He has no national profile, mm-hmm. never showed any national support in any way whatsoever. And he was from, you know, one of the tiniest states that we have in this country. And it yeah. happens to be the state that charges no corporate taxes and has the easiest corporate incorporation laws wow. in the entire country. Now, so that Pelosi and Schumer are together bringing forth Biden, you know, is not some accident of people reading surveys, electability surveys, and saying, hey, let's put our efforts behind them. They're the ones who brought him into the race. He wouldn't even be in this race. An old man who's never gotten any votes, he wouldn't, you know, he had no motive to get in the race. He was brought into this race by the power structures. And now, over the last 5 days, we have been able to bear gruesome witness to just how powerful those powers are and how ruthlessly they wield their power.
Wow. So before we say goodbye to our audience, Steve, you're running for Congress in New York 19. You're running as a Green. So
yes, I am.
I invite your challengers to come on All Exits Closed and speak about the issues that we're talking about today. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. But people really need to think about what we witnessed this week. And if they don't want it happening, they have to very much tell themselves, these are only one-third of the delegates. This primary is not over. You do not have to surrender to the momentum theory. There is still plenty of time for us to say, this is not in our interest, just like the Republicans did in 2016 when they decided to ignore Jeb Bush, that the establishment was telling them needed to be their candidate and was the most electable. And they completely overthrew that. They rose up and overthrew that and forced the Republican establishment to cope with the aftermath of it, right? And they ended up mm-hmm. winning with an unelectable candidate, with a supposedly unelectable candidate. They ended up winning. Okay, and so we as ordinary people, you Democrats, because I'm not a Democrat, I don't get to vote, but the Democrats out there who can see that this is what has happened, you have to rededicate yourself, the urgency of rededicating yourself and not accepting the dictates of the leadership and the people that are paying them, and do the same thing that the Republicans did in 2016, which is go to the ballot booth and say no. Say, you guys are going to have to deal with the candidate we want. You're going to have to accommodate that Because that is the path to victory. That is what to do. You make them accommodate what the voters want. And then, you know, yeah, the pendulum will swing back to them sometime in the future. But this is inarguably the worst possible time to listen to the same people telling you the same tropes about what constitutes electability. They lost. The people that overthrew their party's tropes about electability, they won. Because the power structure wants to win, and they will adapt themselves to whichever candidate the voters bring forth. It's not the end of the world for them. They will adapt. And that is how victory will be achieved. So don't fall for any of these momentum tropes on top of the elect. Momentum is whatever the voters do with it. Obviously, Biden's voters were able to stop Bernie's momentum on Tuesday, but anybody else can go out and stop Biden's momentum when their own primary comes up. And they really need to do that and tell all their friends to come along and do it with them.
Mm. So, Steve, our time is up for today. And like I said, you know, you're running in New York 19 as a Green. I welcome your opponents to come on the show to talk about student loan debt. But I look forward to talking with you next week, and I'm sure something will come up that we will have a great discussion. So you have a great day. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
Thanks.